Which Way LA is made possible in part by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the Nathan Cummings Foundation, the Rosalind and Arthur Gilbert Foundation, and the John Randolph Haynes and Dora Haynes Foundation, which supports study and research into policy issues of the Los Angeles region.
Car camping on the streets of Venice. Hello again, I'm Armin Alney, and this is Which Way L.A., KCRW's ongoing series on the issues Southern Californians care about. Venice once was the hippest hangout west of Greenwich Village or south of San Francisco's North Beach. The boardwalk still makes it one of L.A.'s prime tourist attractions, but rising rents and home prices have created a culture clash. Now middle-class residents are at war over people who live in their cars, their RVs, and their campers, with cops and elected officials and city agencies caught in the middle. We'll hear about a recent incident involving the dumping of human waste. Later on, would returning to nature make for a safer New Orleans? First, here's the news. Warren Olney back with Which Way L.A. on KCRW. 5 years after Katrina, President Obama said yesterday he's making good on his promise to protect New Orleans. But he barely mentioned the strategy most experts say would make the biggest difference of all, restoring the wetlands. We'll hear more about that later on. First, vehicle dwellers in Venice. A long-running dispute flared up again last week after a neighborhood watch captain claimed she saw a woman passenger in a large camper dispose of human waste in a gutter. The watch captain got the license number and called the police as the vehicle pulled away, spilling sewage and toilet paper behind it. That was on the Marina Peninsula, but the cops caught up with the camper blocks away in Venice. The passenger was arrested and then let go, but now City Attorney Carmen Trutanic says he plans to prosecute. That sounds good to Mark Ryavec of the Venice Stakeholders Association. Mark Ryavec, good to have you back on our program.
Warren, very nice to have an opportunity to talk with you about this.
Why is it that you think people of this kind should be prosecuted?
Well, we have a 10-year problem with lots of folks living in vehicles in Venice, and the city's tolerance of their being here and this sort of third world kind of behavior, it's really not acceptable here in a residential community. It's probably not acceptable anywhere, except maybe in a third world country. And there's been a lax attitude by the LAPD and by the city to treating with this as a serious public safety and health problem. This is not the first incident. We see this going on all the time. The folks living in these vehicles, if they're in RVs, frequently they're decrepit. They're 20 or 30 years old, and they leak sewage, even if folks aren't actively, consciously dumping it. The other problem we face, Warren, is that we have a whole lot of folks that are living in cars, vans, panel trucks, and so forth that have no onboard restroom facilities. And so these folks frequently will use our residents' yards, alleys, parkways as their personal toilets. It's really, really disgusting. I mean, my first experience of it was, you know, probably 10 or 12 years ago when a camper parked in front of my house, stayed overnight, and when they left a jar of urine on the curb. And it was sort of a mindless kind of behavior that struck me as really odd. They certainly could have taken it themselves someplace to property dispose of it. So we're pleased that Carmen Trutanic is going to prosecute this incident, and we are hoping he'll follow on with prosecuting the city's ban on living in vehicles.
This incident occurred a long way from Venice and on the Marina Peninsula. Is there a connection?
Well, first of all, the Marina Peninsula is a part of Venice. It is legally in the Venice district of Los Angeles. And when they followed this vehicle, what they found is two other significant sewage dumps right on 3rd Street. And they had to have the hazmat team in all night to clean up that location. They had the cops came in. They had to move 15 vehicles, and, you know, most of them RVs and campers, out of the way. And then they had to spend, you know, significant city resources to clean up and sanitize this entire area. The next day, same vehicles are back, and they're still doing the same thing. It's sort of a recurring problem. And, you know,
We understand what the issue is. Mike Rajovic, again, president of the Venice Stakeholders Association. We'll come back talk with you further in just a minute. First, I want to talk to our Which Way LA producer, Daryl Satzman. He went out to the streets of Venice. I think he was on 4th Street rather than 3rd, and found that the driver of the camper involved in that recent incident is pretty well known to people who live in their vehicles there. Daryl?
Yeah, I talked to a gentleman named Scott who's a middle-aged man who for the past 7 years has been living in a small camper, parking it on the Venice streets. And he said this couple was well-known, not very well-liked, considered rude, and that this kind of behavior was out of the ordinary and angered most of the fellow RV dwellers, although he did acknowledge that there are a fair amount of people who engage in this kind of rude behavior. He said that it's really the exception rather than the rule.
Let's hear from Scott.
All of the RV dwellers were upset with him that he would allow that to leak and happen because of partly how it reflected on the rest of us and because that it just doesn't smell good, you know? And we were parked next to him. For the sake of the RV dwellers and for the sake of the homeowners, a dumping station right there on Lincoln and Rose would be pretty easy at the Chevron because they have a bathroom there already, and all they need to do is make an adjacent pipeline that goes to the outside, and that's all that is necessary. There's no special dumping station really needed, just a pipe that goes straight into your sewage system. That would really solve a huge problem right now that homeowners seem to think that people who live in RVs might dump their stuff.
Now, Scott, in addition to saying that this has angered his fellow RV dwellers, he says it's really increased the heat on them from the police as well.
I would say in the last 3 years, I have noticed an increase of people living in vehicles, and I think that's due to the economic climate. And it's interesting because I know people who live in RVs that are I know a professional novelist who is published. I know lawyers. I know a doctor. I know ex-teachers. I know veterans. You know, I know so many people that are living in RVs, and they're not users or some or people that need help or healing in some way. They're just living in an RV, and that's what they have chosen.
Again, that's Scott, who was on the street. We'll get back to him and to our producer, Daryl Satzman, as well. Mark Rajovic, back to you with the Venice Stakeholders Association. What do you say to what we just heard from Scott?
Well, I have two thoughts about that. One, the residents I represent do not believe that Venice is or should be an urban RV park. And we think the concept of putting in sewage dumping facilities in Venice is something akin to giving alcohol to a drunk. It's enablement. It basically supports people to make this lifestyle choice to live on our streets, and which have problems that are not just related to the dumping and leaking of sewage. They take up very dear parking. They frequently will party late at night. They create a lot of noise. They run generators. And they're also a generator of various kinds of crime, drug sales, prostitution, been documented by the LAPD. I think the majority of residents, the great majority of residents, would like them to do what Supervisor Yaroslavsky suggested a year ago, which was that they need to go to proper campgrounds with proper facilities and get out of a residential neighborhood. But Warren, the other issue I'd point out is that Scott identified what we think is one of the perception problems. There are a lot of people in the RVs who can afford apartments. This is a lifestyle choice, and if they want to make that lifestyle choice, then they should absorb all the costs, which include going somewhere and paying to live in a proper campground.
Still here in the studio is Daryl Satzman. Lifestyle choice, what does Scott do for a living?
Scott works out on the Venice Boardwalk. He has a henna tattoo stand that he operates.
He didn't indicate how much money he makes off that.
No, he didn't. But he indicated that his lifestyle didn't afford him enough money to rent an apartment.
Not in Venice, where the rates have been going up for a long, long time. Linda Lux is president of the Venice Neighborhood Council. She also serves on the City of LA's Board of Neighborhood Commissioners. Linda Lux, good to have you on our program.
Nice to be here, Warren. How are you?
Do you have a different view of this from your neighbor, Mark Rajovic?
Well, yes. I think homelessness, for whatever reason, is ubiquitous, and it's been around a long time, and just pushing people from one community to the other is not solving any problem. I think the person that spoke before, Scott, saying providing some facilities to prevent such a crime from happening again, dumping, nobody wants that to happen. It's really terrible. It shouldn't happen anywhere. But which came first, the chicken or the egg? If you don't have proper facilities to people and something like this happens, how can you say you did anything to solve the problem? There are many ways to solve the problem, one of which would be to provide appropriate facility for people who don't have onboard facilities to dump their waste, while we go forward, which the city is going forward and the neighborhood council supports, going forward with a Streets to Homes program that will get people who want and need help off the street into safe parking with social services that will give people a hand, which will make the police's job much easier, separating out people that are truly in need and wanting help from those who may be choosing a lifestyle or maybe a criminal. Nobody is supporting that. Secondly, there's the city council, and you'll hear from Mike Bonin, I guess, who is passed an overhead vehicle ordinance, which will begin by the end of the year, as the state safe Streets to Homes program will begin, hopefully by the end of the year, moving large vehicles off the streets. That's also something the neighborhood council is very supportive. We also have supported and have initiated with the LAPD both a homeless task force unit that's working in Venice Beach, and also a very strong public safety committee that has been initiated since I took over the presidency just in June. And we look forward to building neighborhood watches so people are much more aware and vigilant about their neighborhoods. The woman that found this particular person that dumped is a neighborhood watch captain. We applaud that, and we want neighborhood watch captains on every block to be preventive. So there's two ways to do it. There's pushing people away and saying, I don't want them in my neighborhood, but I don't care what they do and I don't care about them. I think that's heartless. I think it's inhumane. It doesn't accept the reality that's on the ground. We have a hard economic situation. I would guess that a lot of people are not there by choice, but until we know who they are, until there's a survey, there's no way to tell. You can hypothesize and you can pick into a few people here and there, but we don't know who these people are. I remember not many months ago, a 97-year-old woman was found in Venice with her two sons. Got a lot of news. She ultimately got housing. We don't know how many families are out there. We don't know. And until we are able to help count them and find those that need help and get them off the streets, we don't know who's left. So I just know, as a neighborhood council president, and our council is very much in favor of moving forward to finding solutions to the problems that are not all just chase them away, and if I don't see them, they don't exist, and I don't care. And I think that's morally wrong.
Linda Lux, the president of the Venice Neighborhood Council. Daryl Sassman, did you ask Scott about this question? We heard him say a moment ago that this is a choice. Did he say that more than once? I mean, does he really mean that?
Well, I think he did mean it. For a lot of folks, he did see it as a choice. He mentioned the doctors and writers that he saw out there. But he was also quick to mention that in the past few years, he's seen quite a few people who have been forced out of their apartments turning up on the streets in vehicles, including many who lived in Venice.
It's most unfortunate, the way things have gotten lately. I mean, I've had my own license run three times in the last 3 days by police right here in this spot, because I've been waiting for a mechanic to help me get to the next level with repairing my motor on this. And, you know, I can imagine it might be good if I was, you know, a drug dealer or something like that, that I've been looked at so closely. But, you know, on a whole nother level, I have a lot on my plate. I'm trying to continue my art on the boardwalk, which, you know, is another part of this whole process of cleaning everybody out. They want all the artists off the boardwalk too, and so for my own part I'm getting pressure from every side right now because of the gentrification issue, I guess.
Scott, again, feeling pressure from all sides. Mike Bonin, mentioned earlier by Linda Lux, his chief of staff for Councilman Bill Rosendahl, another person who seems to be feeling pressure from all sides. Mike Bonin, good to have you on our program.
Good to be here, Warren. Thanks for shedding some light on an important issue.
You seem to be in the middle here between Linda Lux and Mark Rajovic.
Well, and appropriately so, I think. What is important to to realize about this issue. You have a subject here in this discussion, and it's RVs in Venice. And that is a single phenomenon, but that phenomenon masks many, many different problems. There is no one type of person who lives in an RV. There are some very rude and unsavory people who are causing trouble in the neighborhoods and committing crimes, and we want them out. There are some people who are making a lifestyle choice to live essentially rent-free on our streets and in our residential neighborhoods, and we're not interested in subsidizing their lifestyle at the expense of the quality of life of people who live in Venice. But there's also another segment of people, families, veterans, people who've lost their jobs, who are down on their luck, who are hanging on to the very bottom rung of the ladder, who are about to wind up being homeless and sleeping on the streets in sleeping bags. And we don't want that either. And so what the councilman has been trying to do is come up with a balanced approach that marries enforcement with social services. And Linda talked about the Streets to Homes program that we're trying to put together with Mike Arnold, as I sort of preview one of your other guests, from Los Angeles Homeless Services Authority, that will, first of all, identify those people who are in need of help and who want help. And if they are willing to do certain things, accept case management, get on a path to housing, follow certain rules, we will give them a designated place to park and to sleep that will be monitored, that will have bathroom facilities, that will prevent the type of reprehensible dumping incident we saw this past week, and will help them get on with their lives and mainstream back into society.
Where is the parking place going to be?
What we're going to do is we are going to work with the community, with neighborhood councils, with LASA, and whomever is selected as a social service provider to help identify locations. We've had some of the neighborhood councils in our district in Westchester and Del Rey that are already looking forward to finding some locations and have begun to identify some. In the two cities that we've modeled this program after, Eugene, Oregon, and Santa Barbara, churches, social service facilities, government offices have tended to be the places that have first stepped forward. In Santa Barbara, the program has been so successful that some construction sites and some small businesses have asked to opt into the program because it gets them someone there overnight who essentially provides some security. But it's also important to note, though, that's just one of the things the councilman's doing. The other is, as Linda also indicated, is the oversized vehicle ordinance, which will prohibit vehicles over 7 feet in height and 22 feet in length from parking on our streets from 2 to 6 a.m. What has been particularly successful about the Santa Barbara program is by providing the services, it has allowed enforcement, the other side, to be more effective. A lot of times when a cop will try to identify someone who's breaking the law by sleeping in their vehicle, That's kind of hard to prosecute. By the time they open the door, they're awake, and so it's been difficult to win a prosecution. Some prosecutors have said this case isn't strong enough. Some judges or juries have taken sympathy, thrown it out. If we're providing social services and we have a pathway for those who want and need help, it makes it easier for the cops to identify the lawbreakers, and it makes it easier to win a conviction. So it's a balanced approach, and we're trying to do both things at the same time.
Mike Bonin, Chief of Staff for Councilman Bill Rosendahl. Daryl Satzman, when you talked to Scott, what did he say about the kinds of programs that are being suggested here?
He thought there was merit in the programs, but he wasn't convinced that a large percentage of the people who are living in their vehicles would take advantage of them. Some of those people have drug problems, others mental health issues. And there's also the question of not wanting to get into the types of services that the county would require or the city would require for people to stay in those areas.
I don't see it as a realistic option to make everyone happy just because it's like a program, and I don't think anyone wants to be sleeping in their RV and have someone with a clipboard walk up to their door and say, you know, have you looked for a job today, or have you, you know, be on them like that.
Let me go back to Linda Lux, the president of the Venice Neighborhood Council. When you hear Scott, with whom you've expressed some sympathy, say what he just did, what do you think? And does the program outlined by Mark Arnold really have a chance? By Mike Bonin really have a chance?
Well, you know, it's going to take good faith on all sides to look to try this. I mean, it hasn't been done in Venice, and I wanted to also say this is not just a Venice problem. It's more visible because the cameras love to go to Venice and radio loves to go to Venice. But this is a regional problem. This is a state problem, and everyone's looked the other way. And unfortunately, because other cities have not been good neighbors, they've pushed people to Venice. So I just wanted to say that we're looking at this as a regional problem. Yes, there will be people in all cases, whether it's medical or other, that don't want to be compliant, and I'm not really concerned with them, as Mike Bonin said, and that we're looking for the people who do have good faith, who will want to try the program. And there's no way to know except to look at the examples of the programs that are working. And that's what I know the council office is trying and what the neighborhood council supports. How can you predict the future? You can't. Will it solve the whole problem? No way. But will it take a stab in the right direction and act in good faith? You bet. And I just can't see any other way than to try it and be positive about it. And I work closely with the police department as well, and they are in favor of creative solutions to this problem, including providing sanitation services in the meantime, because this program won't be up and running tomorrow, and neither will the overheight vehicle ordinance be up. The signs won't be up tomorrow.
Okay.
In the meantime, we have to prevent another incident like this from happening. We have to provide services, and the city can do that. It's much less expensive to provide a sump truck, for example, than it is to bring out hazmat every time there is an incident, and hopefully there'll never be another one. But it would be, you know, it's prevention. If BP had put in the valve that it didn't want to pay for, we might have prevented the spill in BP. It's a big analogy, but you can use it. If you use prevention, it's less expensive than cleanup. So you have to work in good faith with all the community, and you just can't say no, and you have to have compassion, in my opinion. And then I've lived in Venice 40 years, so I'm totally compassionate with my neighbors. I've lived there. I've seen it all. I don't like it either. I represent all Venice, and we need to solve the problem.
As advertised, Mike Arnold is with us. He's executive director of the L.A. Homeless Services Authority. Mike, thank you very much for joining us. To what extent is this a problem throughout the city, not just in Venice?
Thanks, Warren. It's certainly a problem throughout the city, but I think the issue is that it gets compressed in the Venice area. You know, Venice has a great climate. If you're talking about folks who lack resources, very often the RVs that they happen to be living in don't have functioning systems, much less air conditioning, so living in a cooler climate may in fact be a little bit of survival as well as trying to survive without actually living on the streets.
Okay, let me go back to Mark Rajovic with the Venice Stakeholders Association. You said earlier that there was a lax attitude by the LAPD. The city wasn't doing much. Sounds to me like they are, and the police are doing as well as they can, are they not, given all that we've heard?
No, Warren, they aren't. Let me come back to several of the points that have been raised here.
First, quickly as you can. We're running short of time.
First of all, the Dockweiler facility where they have the sewage disposal is 6 miles south of Venice Beach. This is not an incredible distance for these folks to travel. Next, I think it's important to understand that the program that Mr. Arnold is talking about and that Linda is talking about and Mike's talking about is at this point a myth. It's a work in progress that has no legs at the moment. In fact, I met with Mr. Arnold 2 weeks ago, and he readily admitted that he only thought at max 25% of the folks living in vehicles in Venice would be interested in participating. So you have a huge group that we already know are not going to participate in this program.
So, Mike Arnold, we heard that from Scott as well. How do you respond to that?
Well, I think we need to make sure that we set it into context. As we've heard from most of the folks who've talked about the issue, there are more than just homeless people living in recreational vehicles in the Venice area. And I'm part of the Homeless Services Authority. Our job is to identify and help people who lack resources and are truly homeless start that pathway back to stable permanent housing. And in my comments with Mark, you know, again, before, as Linda mentioned, before we've actually done an assessment, We don't know how many folks are living there because it's a lifestyle choice. We don't know how many people are living there because it's a commuting pied-à-terre that they happen to live in because they work on the boardwalk 5 days a week.
Okay, so Mark Rajevic says it's just intolerable to have them there until you can figure out how to deal with them on a more reasonable basis. Get them out of there.
Well, and I think the point being, what exactly are we going to do with them, particularly those who are resourceless? What we've done for many years is, again, shoo them from one community to another. We don't solve the problem. The good news about the Streets to Homes program is that we know that connecting people with resources and case management sets them on a pathway that gets them back into stable permanent housing. If we don't make that connection, these folks are going to just be shooed from one neighborhood to another neighborhood for the next 5 or 10 years. It doesn't solve the problem permanently.
Okay, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but we're simply out of time. Just have one final comment from Scott, the man that Daryl Satzman talked to out on 4th Street in Venice.
I know a couple of people who are refusing to use their tanks right now because the climate is so dangerous. And we are public enemy number one, you know? We deal with stink eye all day from most people, you know, and God knows that makes you see what angels truly are, the people who treat you like a human being.
Scott, again, living on the streets of Venice. Thanks to Daryl Satzman, our producer, and to all of our guests, Mike Arnold, Executive Director of the L.A. Homeless Services Authority, Mike Bonin with Councilman Bill Rosendahl, Linda Lux, President of the Venice Neighborhood Council, Mike Rajevic, the President of the Venice Stakeholders Association. Check out our Which Way L.A. Facebook page. In a moment, would a return to nature make for a safer New Orleans on Which Way L.A.? Warren Olney back with Which Way L.A. Yesterday, on the 5th anniversary of Hurricane Katrina, President Obama was in New Orleans to address a crowd at Xavier University.
Just as I pledged as a candidate, we're going to finish the system by next year so that this city is protected against a 100-year storm. We should not be playing Russian roulette every hurricane season. And we're also working to restore protective wetlands and natural barriers. They were not only damaged by Katrina, they were not just damaged by Katrina, but had been rapidly disappearing for decades.
President Obama at Xavier University yesterday, as to restoration of those protective wetlands, that, quote, could mean more to the future of post-Katrina New Orleans than any number of levees, tourists, or Super Bowl victories. That's from last week's Time magazine and an article by Tim Padgett. And Tim Padgett, thanks a lot for being with us.
Hi, thank you.
Why is so much attention being paid, so much importance given to restoring the wetlands?
Well, because the fact is a lot of people feel that not enough attention has been paid to restoring the wetlands. A lot of the lion's share of the attention is going to this new system of levees that's being built around the city, because it was the levees that failed and allowed the storm surge from Hurricane Katrina to inundate the city back in 2005. And so that's where everyone has been sort of, as I said, focusing their attention these days. But a lot of engineers and environmentalists are saying, whoa, I mean, it's very nice that we're putting these new stronger levees in place, but we've also got to restore these wetlands because they are really what serves as a natural buffer against the strength of storms like Katrina as they come onto the Gulf Coast and batter cities like New Orleans.
What's happening to them?
Well, it's what has happened to them in the past 50 years, starting with, again, the culprit, as is so often the case in this story, the Army Corps of Engineers, which back in 1965 completed a shipping channel from the Gulf Coast to the city of New Orleans, which is known as the Mississippi River Gulf Outlet Canal. The problem with that shipping canal is that it allowed Gulf salt water to come into these natural freshwater swamps that served as these storm buffers, as I said, and just utterly degraded those marshlands to the point that they just became absolutely impotent in the face of storms like Katrina to do anything to soften and weaken the storm surges that as we know, ultimately broke down those shoddy levees back in 2005.
So you say this is a problem that's been going on for 50 years. How much attention has the federal government, the state of Louisiana, given to it?
Well, as I said, not as much as they've given to the levees, because let's face it, politically, fixing those levees was the more expedient thing politically and psychologically, I think, in the minds of many New Orleanians. That's why one of the things that now that the wetlands are starting to become a priority now, one of the things they want to do is get more new citizens in New Orleans and Louisiana sort of engaged in this effort. They're building platforms out there where you can go and look out and see what they're doing to bring the wetlands back to life, to remind locals that, look, you know, never again can you let these wetlands become as degraded and empty as they are now. 50 years ago, there used to be, you could look out from downtown New Orleans and see these beautiful cypress and tupelo trees out in the central wetlands there. And these were the things that were, as I said before, softening storms before they could come in and hit Louisiana and New Orleans. And now, you know, as I say in my story, you look out there, there's just nothing but, these sort of gray stumps of dead cypress trees poking up out of the surface, and they don't do anything at all.
Tim Padgett again, Miami Latin American Bureau Chief for Time Magazine, author of a story on what's happening in New Orleans in the last edition of the magazine. Alexander Kolker is assistant professor with Louisiana University's Marine Consortium. He's also an adjunct professor at Tulane University. Professor Kolker, thanks a lot for being on our program.
It's great to be here.
Elaborate a little bit, on what we just heard from Tim Padgett. How is it that the marshlands with the trees, when they're there, can, in fact, as he put it, soften the impact of a hurricane?
Okay, well, they provide a buffer between the land and the sea, so there are areas where having this physical stretch of land is an area that waves can shoal on. The wetlands can buffer the storm energy, and it depends, something on the details of what kind of wetland you have out there. If you've got the big variable really is how tall the plants are relative to the storm surge. If you've got a lot of cypress forests out there that are, of course, quite strong, quite tall trees, you can physically break up the waves and cause the waves to crash further out to sea and really reduce the storm surge. Of course, if you just have marsh grasses and you've got a Katrina-style, at least the kind of storm surge that hit Mississippi, having a few feet of marsh grass is not going to help versus a 30-foot storm surge, the kind of thing that hit Mississippi. Just to put a few things into perspective of what our previous speaker was talking about, the problems of wetland loss, the Mississippi River Gulf outlet it's certainly a major factor in the wetland loss in east of New Orleans, but it's not the only factor. The area is subsiding. It's subsiding under its own weight. It's naturally soft sediments that are compacting, and the area is not receiving the new sediment deposition. We've channelized the Mississippi River. We've done that largely to prevent river floods, but also to keep the channel flowing fast so it kicks more sediment out to sea. And that channelization of the Mississippi River has caused, basically prevented sediments from entering these wetlands. So when they subside under their own weight or for some human-induced reason, they don't build up like they should because they're not getting the sediments that they should. So those are two things that I think are worth putting in perspective.
There's much more to do then than just plant cypress and tupelo trees, I take it. If there is this subsiding and it's caused by the fact that the river has been diverted, what has to be done to restore or to allow the sediment to start being deposited again?
So the strategy that many people are talking about is to partially divert the flow of the Mississippi River, to basically strategically open up a hole in the levee. Probably you don't actually want a gate so you could control it in certain targeted areas to let the river flow through, to let it flow, if not its natural course, something close to its natural course. And that would allow fresh water to come in, which would be good for cypresses and some of the taller vegetation, and it would import sediments. And the sediments would allow these areas to build up. And there's a lot of natural examples or semi-natural examples that this can work. Over west of Louisiana, in the west Louisiana, by the mouth of the Atchafalaya River, we're building actually new deltas out there. And that's because the Atchafalaya River gets roughly 30% of the Mississippi River water. And there are a few spots down at the mouth of the Mississippi River where the Mississippi is, again, flowing through some, basically some natural or unnatural, or partially flowing through some levees down there, where we are also creating some new land. So there's a lot of good natural examples that this could happen.
And, excuse me, Alexander Kolker at Louisiana University and Tulane University. Let me introduce Kyle Graham. He's Deputy Director in the Office of the Governor for Coastal Activities. Kyle Graham, thank you for being with us.
Oh, thanks for having me.
How much effort is the state putting into this restoration of the wetlands, or is it because the Army Corps of Engineers has been so much of a presence there, primarily, do you think, a federal responsibility?
Well, most of the programs that we have ongoing are federal state programs, and the programs that come to mind, we actually have three large ones. One's the CWPRA, which is the Coastal Wetlands Planning, Protection, and Restoration Act, which was done in 1990. That's a multi-agency federal side, and then, of course, the state. And it's a cost-shared program. We pay 15% into that program. To give you some numbers on that, there's typically combined about $100 million worth of activities done a year, somewhere in the $65 to $80 million put up by the federal side. Another one that comes to mind, or another big program we have, is the Coastal Impact Assistance Program, and this was passed in 2005. This is more of a grant-type program through which revenues from outer continental shelf oil and gas production is sent to those OCS-type states, and those monies are then brought either through the state or through our parishes to do coastal restoration projects. Since 2005 in that program, we've done about $50 million worth of projects, and we have another $75 million currently underway. The third program that we've been working on that was really brought on post-Katrina is what we call the Louisiana Coastal Area Program. And that program was authorized in the Water Resources Development Act of 2007. It was really the counterpart to the protection around New Orleans. We knew that we needed a true integrated approach post-Hurricane Katrina. We had the hurricane protection system that is ongoing in New Orleans, and then they also got this program, this LCA program, authorized in what is, you know, Water Resources Development Act, or WRDA 2007. It's about an $8 billion program. That one is fundamentally led by the Corps of Engineers. We cost share into that program as well. That program has not turned a piece of dirt to date, and it's a lot of it is the processes and a lot of the projects and the large-scale projects that they're getting underway. It's been very ineffective of clearing a lot of the hurdles, whether environmental or public concern, to get some of those projects. In total, the state has put up, since Katrina, a little over $1 billion. Now, that's in our integrated approach. We have not begun to pay our cost share necessarily toward the protection system, but we've been very active in trying to do both the protection side and the restoration. And to that end, this year we will be experiencing, or we're anticipated to experience, the lowest land loss rates since we've essentially been keeping track of them, definitely over the last 30 years. So we're very much trying to push things forward. As you've heard, though, the river is really the key, and that's where we've been stuck in a lot of what the Corps of Engineers has control over.
Again, Kyle Graham is Deputy Director in the Office for the Governor of Coastal Activities. Let me go back to Professor Kolker. When it said that we have now the lowest land loss rates in many years, that suggests that land is still being lost. What are the prospects of actually catching up?
You know, like, the prospects are there. If we divert the flow of the river, we certainly can create land. And I think that we, you know, we've, land is still being lost here at tremendous rates, and even if we get down to the lower rates that that Kyle Graham was talking about, they'd still be, you know, among the highest in the nation, and really among, and probably among the highest rates on Earth. I mean, they're just incredibly high, even if they're lower than.
Can you give us some sort of estimate?
We're talking about, you know, on an average year, we're talking about 50 square kilometers, 20 something square miles a year. So still very, very high rates.
Wow.
That's sort of in an average year, and that's down, let's say, in the 1970s, the rates were about 100 square kilometers a year, so 60, 70-something square miles. So there, you know, there is certainly a chance that we can catch up, and like we were saying, the river is the key. One thing that that people are also talking about, and I'd like to sort of riff off this idea of the integrated approach, there is an idea that's sort of floating around New Orleans, that we need to have this idea of multiple lines of defense. We can't have either or levees or wetlands. We need to have a full multiple lines of defense, and that includes everything from natural defenses, including the outer continental shelf, barrier islands, beach ridges, chenilles, wetlands. That also includes levees, and the multiple lines of defense also includes, safe evacuation routes. And those are some ideas that have been put out particularly by the Lake Pontchartrain Basin Foundation. And in many ways, that's a good strategy for coastal restoration, is that we don't just need wetlands, which we definitely need. We don't just need barrier islands, which we definitely need. We don't just need levees, which we definitely need. We need all of them.
Back to Kyle Graham in the governor's office in Louisiana. What are the prospects that the kinds of money, I don't think we even talked in the correct order of magnitude here, could possibly be generated?
I think they're pretty good, and especially, the oil spill has done a tremendous amount of damage, of course, to our wetlands and to the fisheries therein. But it also, there's an opportunity there for some of the funding that we might need to finally get some of these large-scale restoration projects off the ground.
You mean you get it from BP?
Yeah, BP, there's a couple avenues there. One are working on, as you're probably aware, there's this natural resource damage assessment process through which it takes multiple years to evaluate what is going on in the Gulf and all the various damages that have occurred from the spill. There's also there's this ability within there to push some projects initially to get them out of the way, and I think that the federal government as well as the states are very much looking toward BP to fund some of these urgent projects, and so that could put some forth. There's also, through the Clean Water Act, some fines that could be levied by the EPA, and under that, there's the ability for them to utilize some environmental projects in lieu of their fines, or to put together a package that consists of both monetary fines as well as some of these projects to move some of those forward. The third piece that we have is that we do have an offshore oil and gas revenue sharing mechanism. It's referred to as GOMESA, and it hasn't really been in effect yet for Louisiana, but in 2017 and then again in 2055, our share actually starts to ramp up, and we might get into the hundreds of million dollars and toward the $1 billion of revenue that would be needed to sustain such a program. And here in Louisiana, we actually passed a constitution amendment that steers all of those monies directly toward our restoration and protection program. So really, it's how do we get now to 2017 and 2020 so that we can sustain the long-term effort? And once we get there, I think that we have a lot of those mechanisms in place.
You're talking pretty far down the line if, in fact, 20 square miles a year are being lost, and that's a low level. Is there going to be anything left by the time the money is available?
That's another good question. Yeah, absolutely. It doesn't happen in It's not an ongoing every day. It weakens. There's large hurricanes, and you have larger events that blend it together. You know, part of the thing that we're looking at is if you look at the system holistically, we need the sediment out of the river to kind of keep that subsidence rates that were discussed earlier at bay. And we have some sediment limitations. We have a very large coastal wetlands area, and so a lot of it is sitting back and looking at what is the sustainable footprint and where do we put our best efforts. But yes, there's absolutely a sustainable footprint in Louisiana, and it's really trying to get together with all of the projects and evaluating our resources to make sure that we're identifying where to put our resources.
Kyle Graham, Deputy Director, Office of the Governor for Coastal Activities. U.S. Senator from Louisiana, Mary Landrieu, went to Holland last year, came back and said that levee repair is a system of patch and pray. And advocated that something be done along the lines of what is done in Holland. David Wagoner is principal of Wagoner and Ball Architects, a primary mover in what's called the Dutch Dialogues. And David Wagoner, thanks a lot for being with us.
Thank you for inviting me.
We're talking now about the city of New Orleans. What are the Dutch Dialogues, and what do you look forward to? What change in strategy that you think might work for New Orleans?
Dutch Dialogues was set up to deal with urban water management. The description before about the multiple lines of defense is good and a good place to enter that discussion. We have the coastal wetlands that are vital to restore. We have the levees, the flood walls that are our perimeter defense. But our model has been that we will evacuate inside that, and that's not the way that sophisticated countries live with water. you give space to water, the water comes over, you have somewhere for it to go.
So what would giving it a place to go mean? What does it mean in Holland? How would it be the same? How would it be different in New Orleans?
Well, if you look at a map of Rotterdam or Amsterdam, you would see a lot of blue in that city. If you look at a map of New Orleans, you'd see very little blue. Basically, the idea that we're not going to let rain or stormwater occupy ground would be altered, and you would actually give some space out there where water is in the environment. I happen to be in Venice right now, and this is the wettest place I've ever seen. But you know, giving space to water, if you imagine Venice in Italy, not California, would look like a lot more canals, would look like some more ponds and retention areas.
What would it mean in terms of housing and existing use of the land? Would things have to be moved away to make way for the water?
No. We, in fact, have a lot of blighted and abandoned properties in New Orleans. I think about 27% of our housing is not occupied at present. So we, in fact, have, unlike Holland, we have extra space. So it's a way also to adapt to the condition that we now find ourselves in, which is with abandoned properties. There are also canals that we have in the city that are walled off, and those canals are no asset for economic or benefit or public amenity. So if you can get a water system in place that allows people to approach the water, then you have a more valuable and desirable place. So not only are we trying to, or like the Dutch, create more safety, but you're also trying to create more value, more desirable real estate.
When you're creating canals and ponds, according to the vision that you have, would you also be creating places that would be habitable by people, or would they have to move away?
No, that's the nice thing about water. You know, in New Orleans, we got in trouble with graphics to an extent, but also communication. They're tied. We had the green dot, which was this big fist that came down on neighborhoods, and that rightly energized people to say, well, no, I'm not giving up my neighborhood. But if you imagine instead of a fist, you imagine fingers, water is much more flexible than that. It can, in fact, be kneaded or weaved through areas. So what you would hope is that by putting water in these neighborhoods and operating that water system, you would create real estate with value, and people would want to live next to the water. In fact, that's the pattern of life, that people want to live next to the water. So it would be the opposite. You wouldn't be moving people away. You would hope that people would gather again around these water systems.
David Wagoner, again, principal in Wagoner and Ball Architects, part of the Dutch Dialogues that have been going on for some time. I want to go back to Professor Kolker at Louisiana University and Tulane University. How does this sound to you?
In theory, there's some very good things. I think that it's worth pointing out that when New Orleans was originally built, it was they actually built it living around water, as David Wagoner has suggested, that it, New Orleans was actually settled on a series of high natural levees surrounding the Mississippi River and a few other natural distributary channels. And so there was a very interesting map that was put out by the Times-Picayune, the local newspaper after Katrina, and one was a map of the city in 1880, and the other was a map of the flooding in 2005, and they were almost a complete inverse of themselves. The areas that were built in the 1880s, be they rich or poor today, were dry, and the areas that were built thereafter, be they rich or poor, were flooded. And in effect, what happened is they dried out the wet soil, particularly the wet soils further away from the river, and those sediment soils compressed under their own weight, and they flooded. And so a lot of certainly they have actually built, at one point they built New Orleans with respect to the river. A lot of these houses are elevated. My house, which is an 1880s house, is built on piers down at the Louisiana University's Marine Consortium in Cocodrie, where I work. The building itself is built 12 feet off the ground. It's been through been through hurricanes. It's had hurricanes underneath them, and they've done, you know, only minor damage to, for the most part, because the building is built off the ground. So absolutely there are strategic ways to build with water, and at some point and in some ways that is both the future and it's both the past.
David Wagoner, back to you. We've heard a lot about the Army Corps of Engineers on our program on Friday. We heard some wholesale attacks on what they've done in the past and what they're doing now. Has the Army Corps of Engineers shown any interest in what you're proposing?
A bit. The Army Corps of Engineers would prefer to stay out of urban drainage or urban water systems. They would prefer to build defense systems at perimeters. We have a project in Louisiana, in New Orleans, that's known as SELA, Southeast Louisiana, which is an urban drainage project. The outfall canals were the things that flooded the main drainage basin in New Orleans, the failure of the concrete walls on the outfall canals. The big issue that we confront are the outfall canals. There's an option one, option two that all the locals know about, which have to do with gravity drainage versus pumps and so forth. Those are systems that the Corps of Engineers, in an integrated way, we would like to deal with. They've shown a little interest in approaching this subject. I think if you would put the individuals who work on this, we would energize them or authorize them, they would have a lot of interest in working on this urban drainage system, or the main water system for New Orleans, not the secondary part, but the aorta, the main pumping systems, which we really need to straighten out in a way like the wetland loss, where we've for years suffered. To get whole, we have to have a water system, and the outfall canals are the key to that water system. My hope is that the Corps of Engineers, working with the local water authority, would engage that main water system, and I've had a little bit of daylight given that way.
Okay, back to Kyle Graham, Deputy Director in the Office of the Governor for Coastal Activities. How does this look to the state?
We're very supportive of local efforts in this, and one of the things that we've done is tried to supply them with tools, not just through New Orleans, but for all the coastal parishes, and planning for the future and integrating some of these, not only multiple lines of defense, but new ways toward drainage. We were very supportive in what they were referring to as option two in the canals. And so what we've been doing to date is pushing programs and projects that were either not complete or have been on the books. But looking forward, we're very, very supportive of efforts by the locals and by the scientific and engineering community.
All right. Well, thank you all very much for being on our program. Kyle Graham with the Governor's Office, David Wagoner of Wagoner and Ball Architects, Alexander Kolker at Louisiana University's Marine Consortium, adjunct professor at Tulane, Tim Padgett, our earlier guest, Miami and Latin America Bureau Chief for Time Magazine, wrote a recent piece about New Orleans in the latest edition. Thank you all very much for being on our program. That was a rebroadcast of today's To the Point, Which Way L.A., produced tonight by Daryl Satzman, Christian Bordahl, and Julia Fluch, our managing producer, Cameron Redziner, technical director, Mike Newport. Email us, share your thoughts on our comment page, kcrw.com/whichwayla. I'm Warren Olney. Join us again for Which Way L.A. on 89.9 KCRW.
Which Way L.A. is made possible in part by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the Nathan Cummings Foundation, the Rosalind and Arthur Gilbert Foundation, and the John Randolph Haynes and Dora Haynes Foundation, which supports study and research into policy issues of the Los Angeles region.